previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
Sometimes they say they no like, then use anyway.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210. Today's episode is Season 8, Episode 6, The Right Thing. And now your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah Deepa.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hello.
Ready to talk about these nitwits some more?
Talk? No. Shriek? Enragedly? Yes.
Okay, good. Well, let's start with our C plot. Kelly's brain still broken and still messing things up for Val and Noah and Brandon, but who cares? So we open with Brandon having another nightmare about Kelly's shooting. Things are about to get worse for him, and that when his eyes pop open, Kelly is sitting there in bed awake next to him and calling him Brandon. And I made a gif of him waking up like as if her horror is because it zoomed, the camera like zooms out super fast, and then she's there like as if that's part of what makes this a bad moment for him, which is funny.
She is wearing the like universal sign of no longer trying nighty mm-hmm. and robe combo in bed. I mean, he has a t-shirt on, which duh, but whatever.
She correctly guesses what he was dreaming about and tells him to give himself a break because it wasn't his fault. It was a little. And like four idiotic things are said in a row, and it's kind of remarkable for its efficiency in this clip. Number two.
There's nothing you could have done.
Wrong.
One of those bullets probably had your name on it.
I wish those guys would have had better aim.
Me too.
Don't say things like that. Get this through your thick male ego. You are not the bad guy.
Wrong.
They are.
Thank God I'm in love with a woman with a degree in psychology.
What?
Child psychology.
Even better.
What?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, you don't need to give yourself a break. Oh, no. I wish those bullets had my name on it. Jesus.
Honestly, God.
It's totally his fault.
Yeah.
All of the bullets were meant for him. How does she have a degree in psychology?
I don't know.
And child psychology? Oh, God. Okay. Let's just move on, because what else is there to say?
Honestly. So yeah. Kelly exposits that the lineup is tomorrow and refuses Brandon's offer to postpone it, because if she doesn't go, it'll kill her. It'll kill them. A, if only. B, remember in the last episode when Brandon was like, they caught the guy and he's awaiting trial. So if that's the case, why is there another lineup? Never explained. Moving on. Cooper Hargrove calls Val and invites her to breakfast, and she pretends she's too busy, and he says he knows she has someone coming over, and she's like, are you psychic? And then the doorbell rings, and it's Noah, and Cooper knew that because, of course, Cooper the creep is calling from his tacky stretch limo out front. You can see the visual aids. And there's some stuff as she talks to Cooper on the phone and Noah on the stoop, and he mildly drags the limo client and then also asks her to breakfast, but she turns him down too. And after more confusion, Cooper lets her go with this. Clip number three.
Deal with Mr. Duffel Bag.
No, that's not how that's said.
Mr. Duffel Bag.
What a weirdo. Like, are we supposed to think he's so fancy he doesn't know what a duffel bag is?
Are you the GPS? Proceed onto Triborough Bridge. No.
Deal with Mr. Duffel Bag.
Mr. Duffel Bag. Like, it's the GPS, right?
Yes, you're totally right.
Recalculating. Okay, whatever.
Recalculating. Anyway, Noah is there to do his laundry.
That was a nice bit of business, everyone.
Thank you so much. He's there to do his laundry because he won't be able to do it at sea. He took that job and he's leaving in a couple of days because he has nothing holding him back. So when Cooper calls right back, Val is ready to have breakfast with him after all. And he's so happy, he makes a really dumb face that you can see in the visual aids. It's so dumb, I can't even describe it. You just have to go look at previously.tv. And then Val tells Noah she's just keeping the client happy, but that they should talk. So he directs her to meet him on Slow Dance, Slip 33, but he'll only be there until 6. And then Kelly comes down at the end of this for Clip 4.
Kelly, why are you dressed like that?
How should I be dressed?
For a day on a boat.
Sailing? I'll be right back.
What?
Since when does Princess want to go sailing? She doesn't.
No.
And since your memory's back and you're all better and everything, what about your job at the Foundation? Shouldn't you be...
I was wondering about that too.
Working?
Yeah, especially when they made a point of being like child psychology, like they were trying to establish something that was going to come up in a future future moment of this episode, but it did not.
No.
So I wondered that too.
Yeah. Before this, she also like stopped at the top of the stairs and eavesdropped on Val and Noah's conversation and smirked. So it's like, I guess she remembers that she hates Val too, but that's not really explored either. And also, who cares?
Indeed. So on the boat, Kelly calls the office to return Brandon's 4 messages and tell him where she is. He comments on how many calls Brandon has made. And she says he's been keeping close tabs. She wishes he wouldn't worry so much, but Noah thinks he'll simmer down after the case is over. She's not that confident that she'll remember anything at the lineup and declines Noah's offer to go with them in Clip 5.
You've already done so much for us.
I haven't done anything.
My point, exactly. When I lost my memory about Brandon, you could have taken advantage, but you didn't.
It's my proudest achievement. Believe me.
Gross! That is so gross. I'm sorry.
What? Like, I don't even know. I don't even know how I'm supposed to feel about this because neither right. of them appears to give even a molecule of a shit about this scene or each other. So what?
Right.
I just
like she's essentially thanking him for like not trying to have sex with her when she was not really in a position to give informed consent. And he's like, yeah, good for me. And she's like, yeah, good for you. Like, both of you fuck off.
I know. He's like, the many other times I've had an opportunity to bone amnesia patients who are actually in committed relationships. Believe me, I parked it up that street. Like, cool story, oh log.
Oh, Jesus. So let's move on because we can't. I know. What did we do? So Val is on her way out to meet Noah before he leaves town when Cooper Hargrove appears on her doorstep with flowers and a fancier offer, private jet trip to San Francisco, and Val's only human. Meanwhile, Noah is boating around or whatever when he checks his watch and pouts to himself about how late Val is. And then Brandon meets Kelly for dinner because he's got all the time in the world. Although he is late, and finds her practicing a knot that Noah showed her, which, first of all, Kelly, maybe not at the table, and second, Brandon, she lives with you, you won, shut up, but she knows he's concerned, but she's fine. She's even ready for the lineup tomorrow, and he brays that it'll be easy and that she'll definitely remember, and putting pressure on this moment is absolutely the right call, but he promises her this is going to end. Promise me. Anyway, the next day, Noah comes to see Val, who half-assedly apologizes for blowing him off the previous night. He says he got her message. She's there to pick up her laundry and be passive aggressive in Clip 6.
They're Kelly's.
Wow, Brandon really goes all out, huh? Must be nice to have someone that cares for you like that.
I wouldn't know.
No, I guess not.
Sorry, that was about some flowers on the table.
Yeah, I just love Noah's inadvertent burns. Like, I am still amused by, like, he just doesn't care or can't act like he does. Mm-hmm. The actor can't. I'm still laughing about like, do you want to get a beer later, B? And Brandon's like, no, dick. And Noah's like, cool, all right. Like, okay. It's like delicious cumin later. Okay.
Yep. Totally. So he's not sure when or if he'll ever be back. And Val defensively says it wouldn't have worked between them. And he snaps that she was too afraid to find out if he'd have stayed if she had asked him. And she feels real bad. And at the cop shop, Brandon can't go in for the lineup with Kelly because all of a sudden this detective has a boner for procedure. And by the way, Sarah captured a shot that I had totally missed. Please describe Brandon and the poster because it's gorgeous.
Brandon having tried to basically follow Kelly into the lineup room, but the detective is like a foot taller than him and he puts his arm up and Brandon like bonks his chin on it. And then he and his giant jacket have to like concern brow around in the waiting room. And as he is leaving, he is concerned browing next to this poster against drunk driving. And it says something like, don't do it, or like, don't get caught. And it's like, well, hey, show. Remember when that happened? Well, it did.
Yeah. And by the way, the show's like, nope. Anyway. Kelly says that the shooter isn't there, and Detective Procedure asks if she's sure it's not number one, who is the guy that Brandon picked out. Yeah, like, great lawyering, suspect's attorney, not present, but Kelly is certain. Although her flashback, which we see, doesn't show any faces, so we don't know whether she really didn't see the guy or if she's lying for some reason, but Brandon is, of course, all in a state when she comes out and tells him that the guy wasn't there. And the detective tries to tell them that eyewitness IDs aren't foolproof, but Brandon thinks he knows how to solve the situation. Clip 7.
Kelly, that's the guy. I'll never forget his face.
Neither will I. Not anymore.
You know, I gotta tell you, the DA, he might drop the case.
But that's the guy.
I'm not saying it isn't. But without the victim corroborating, this guy can walk.
And also, what is with the bongos?
I don't know.
This guy can walk straight into a tiki bar.
He can walk or he can samba. Anyway.
I hate this show so much.
I hate it too. Speaking of, here's a good reason why. One commercial break later, Brandon is, surprise, being a bitch about it in clip 8.
What did you want me to do, Brandon? Lie?
No, Kelly, I didn't want you to lie.
You know what? I just went through hell in there. I don't appreciate being punished for it.
I'm just frustrated, okay, Kel? I mean, you have to admit that an immediate ID by someone who didn't go through the trauma of getting shot and didn't have amnesia for almost a month is worth a lot more than the one you gave in there.
It's like the detective said, your mind can play tricks on you.
Exactly. And whose mind has been going through hoops lately, yours or mine?
Brandon, you've been under a lot of stress too. Or did you forget about your nightmares? Or maybe it's that you wanted to ID someone so bad.
That I just picked anyone? I'm right about that guy, Kelly. Just like I was right about the make of the stolen car, the partial
license.
All
right, Brandon, you're right. You're right about everything.
The guitar player be like, I'm still here.
The bongos are like, well, that's us told.
Fuck off, Brandon.
Jesus.
So then Val is standing at Noah's empty slip when he shows up to say that the boat is somewhere else getting supplied because she thought he had already left, but he hadn't. We wish. Val came to tell him that he's wrong for her. She hates the way he lives, what he does, the way he behaves. And when he interjects that he's broke, she doesn't deny that that's part of it. But when he tells her to fast forward to the end, she asks him not to go. She doesn't know what'll change if he stays. But if he leaves now, they'll never find out. And they hug and agree that they're both afraid. No one cares. Kelly is in bed in all the makeup. So much makeup. I had this in my notes, too. So I was so glad that you caught a shot of her looking like a fucking geisha. Like, oh, it's so much makeup.
God, the lips alone, because she has, you know, tiny mouth. But then they try to make it look bigger and then they filled it up with all of the lip gloss. And it's like the minute that she actually touches the pillow with that, they're going to be fused together as one creature forever.
Yep. They are ruined. So that's when Brandon comes home and sits next to her on the bed, pissily. And Kelly says this, an all-timer, clip 9.
It's never going to end.
I know that feel, fam.
Girl, you said a mouthful. A tiny
you said a tiny
mouthful.
You said a tiny cat butt mouthful. Dave, please save that clip forever because we are going to need it forever.
Never gonna end, is it?
It's not. Kelly's like, they're never going to catch the guy. And Brandon just squeezes her shoulder, but doesn't argue because I guess we're supposed to think that he's going to go vigilante him. I don't know.
Ugh.
Because he did say, he told the detective, if he put him in front of him, he would kill him.
Yeah.
So is that a promise or just talk?
Bite his ankles to death? I'm not clear on how that's going to happen. Also, who cares?
On to our B plot. David still sucks at work, boyfriending, and jewelry. Thank you for those additions, Sarah. Very important.
Of course. My pleasure.
David brings the band in to have lunch at the Peach Pit, whereupon Steve razzes him about what he apparently heard from Donna about their anti-Semitic slur in the last episode, because apparently Steve cares about that now. This is a new color for him, as it were. David is disgusted that Donna is telling people that his band are bigots, because he thinks after working so closely with them, if they were racist, he would know. Because, yes, no one is a better judge of character than David, for sure. But he also needs to borrow cash from Steve to cover lunch, as if they're not at the Peach Pit. Later, David is at a recording studio pretending to produce the band's record when a facility manager, who is black, which will be relevant, comes in and tells David that they're about to be out of time. And David whines for another hour, and it turns out that's no problem since there's no one's booked after them, but the guy has to collect for it up front. And David's all, you know, I'm good for it. You've heard these guys. As if that would mean shit to a guy who sees talented losers parade through his workplace daily. And also my kingdom for the beer delivery guy from episode 3 to show up looking baleful at David's claim to be good for the money. That does not occur. David gives this guy a credit card, which the guy hilariously recognizes as one that already got declined on an earlier occasion. Like, you can tell on site. Oh, no, no, not this one. So David tries to offer a different card after the session, but obviously that won't work. And when Devin comes out, David lies that the place is booked up and they're out of time for today, but they can come back the next day at 3. And clip 10.
Is 3 o'clock cool for you?
Yeah, but I got to be somewhere at 6. So just make sure you tell the homeboy that we're not working on African time.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, we got it, piano. It's racist. Got it.
Right. And far be it from me to correct anyone's racism, but that's not the expression I've ever heard bigots use personally.
No. But okay.
Okay, we don't have to say the wrong one.
I guess they just they were like, well, we need to make him a, you know, 8 o'clock hour bigot. Like, do you?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So David then comes home to a big fancy dinner that Donna made, and among his junk mail is an offer for a sketchy credit card. She throws it out, but we watch him watch it go pointedly. And David then defends Devin again against Donna's judgment that he's a bigot just because he said bigoted things. But Donna stands by her opinion in clip 11.
I want you to do well. I'm just not sure I want you to do well with him.
Well, at least the guy I work with doesn't operate sweatshops.
Yeah. And the difference is I'm doing something about it.
You know what? I'm not really hungry. I think I'm just going to go to bed.
Fuck you!
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Really not the same.
No.
I mean,
it's really not. And she is doing something about it. And one of those things does not include wearing silver rings so gigantic that there are other smaller silver rings orbiting them. On like every finger.
On his thumb, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Thumb ring, guys. Nope.
Gross. So gross. Yeah. The next morning, Donna catches David rooting through the garbage looking for the sketchy credit card offer, and they briefly fight some more about Devin before he badly apologizes for ruining her special dinner. And she's upset they don't have time to talk anymore, as opposed to being relieved to have Sir Piss off her ass all the time. But anyway, as soon as she's gone, he calls for the credit card to be activated today. Which I guess that was in those days, like, maybe you did actually get a credit card in the mail just out of the blue. I don't think they do that anymore, but I feel like maybe then they did.
Yeah, no, they did.
I don't know.
They definitely did.
Thank you to the Consumer Protection Financial Board or whatever for stopping those kinds of practices for now. Then the band shows up late for their slot. Devin is a bitch about it. And Devin gives the studio guy, David gives the studio guy his new credit card to pay for the time. And Devin is spectacularly unremorseful about the 2 hours he cost David, which I'm almost more angry about than about a the racism because it's so inconsiderate. Anyway, yeah.
And David, of
course, I know you feel me, early girl.
Does nothing because it's David. Like, you know, you could be late or you could be a racist. I'm just kidding. You can't be a racist, but and you also should not be late. That drives me bug fuck as well.
Yes.
But just David's complete, it's not even intransigence, because that implies some sort of like stubbornness and force of will. He just stands there in his, you know, at sea in his own garments, looking like, you know, Charlie Brown character.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh my God, who cares? And go fuck yourself. Like, you could do better, Donna. Barely, but you could do better.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about this whole band storyline is that, like, admittedly, I mean, we keep saying this, but the industry was different then. Like, you could actually make your life on a band that could have one hit, you know, like that doesn't happen now. But at the same time, like, you would think that David would have remembered from his own brief, quote, career, unquote, in the industry that, like, nothing is sure. So, like, just swallowing a bunch of shit because you think these guys are going to make it big, like, that's, you're really being very hopeful about something that has a tiny likelihood of paying off for you.
Yeah. And like a tiny likelihood of paying off for them. And
right.
The fact is, like, there's someone supposed to pay the producer at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you have a writing credit, I mean, whatever, like, what I don't know about publishing rights is a lot, but it's like, I still know more than David is A. B, who's running the fucking club right now?
Yes.
Or did you just close it and leave it closed after Hawaii because you can't afford to buy any beer?
Ugh, God.
Whatever.
Well, we are not going to find that out this week. On to the A plot, Donna's sweatshop busting inconveniences everyone. So Donna returns to Soho Mix and Match, aka Sweatshop Mix and Match. The Mr. Parrish who hired her says her new designs are sensational. I doubt it. And that she'll be hearing from them soon. Once he goes back to his office, she quits pretending and heads straight to the sweatshop, seeing a preteen kid moving a box and then the burned girl's adult minder who makes
Can I just interrupt here?
Yes, please.
To note that, and you'll see this in the visual aids for one of these episodes, but I think it was this one. Donna's contact at the so-called fashion company.
Oh, yeah, that's this one.
Taken over as the pleated Avenger. Like, you're making design decisions? No wonder you think Donna's shit is good. Oh, brother.
Yeah. Donna also is once again wearing all of the makeup, even though it's clearly daytime. But anyway, the adult minder that has been Donna's contact this whole time makes a hilarious face of disgust when she sees that Donna's back. And Donna tries to convince her, which you can see in the visual aids, Donna tries to convince this woman to talk to her, which of course she doesn't. So Donna gives her Brandon's contact info on the front cover of the Beat. This woman tries to tell her something, but Donna regretfully says she doesn't speak Spanish, making her the perfect person to do whatever this is. And as the women go into work, Donna hears Mr. Parrish go lost and easily plays dumb before taking off.
Yeah.
And after a blessed million hours of B-roll of what is allegedly Beverly Hills, but contains a lot of shots of the Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica, we are with Steve at the Peach Pit trying to convince Carly that the two of them should take Zach to Magic Mountain. And she throws up some momly objections to, for instance, Steve putting lifts in Zach's shoes so that he can go on all the rides, but she'll think about it. And she also asks how he's supposed to take time off work, but he says he'll give himself the day off. He fucking started last week. I'm so mad.
Yeah. Also, you're the publisher. You're always on. Sorry about it.
Yeah. Like, every second you're not trying to hustle ads or keep this shitty paper afloat, like, you are failing. The end. Anyway. So Nana goes to the Beat to discuss what they know about the sweatshop, which isn't much. The woman's name is Alluvia, and Brandon got the name of the building owner. He doesn't know who owns the actual fashion brand because of a paper trail of holding companies, and also he sucks at journalism. I added that part. But he does have records of various workplace safety violations. Donna will keep helping and get Val to cover her afternoon appointments at her other fake job. So Brandon and Donna end up in a fancy Century City office, and they have this discussion, clip 12.
Oh, looks like there's pretty good money in the slumlord business.
We don't know that yet.
Once you have a seat, I'll be right with you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Right, we'll meet with you.
Don?
My God, it's a picture of Rush.
Sanders? How do we tell Steve this? Dad owns a sweatshop.
I have no idea.
Well, first of all, it sounds like the Casio has some suggestions, so talk to her. Second of all, of course there's pretty good money in the slumlord business, you
Thank
dingleberry.
You.
That's why people are slumlords.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we can move on now.
Also, when you're involved in some kind of shady dealings, a good thing to do is put your photo and name up in your reception area for literally anyone to see. I'm just saying.
He looks drunk as well in the photo, not for nothing.
Oh, yes. It's clearly like thing. He's not looking at the camera either. Like they just captured him at some weird corporate retreat or something. Like it's a very weird photo to use in this context. Anyway, Val covers Donna's appointment with some old bag and totally sells out Donna for the flights of fancy that took her away today. And Val puts the most inflammatory possible spin on the situation by saying that Donna's gotten involved with a sweatshop, which yes and no. And the old bag client crabs that she can't wear any sweatshop clothes, what with the closet full of furs she already can't wear. How inconvenient.
I kind of loved that they just like completely committed to this one big like, ugh, PETA. Like, okay, sure.
Mm-hmm. But Val claims that she picked all of these out at great stores. She didn't. And Mrs. Dowager says that Val should never let anyone take credit for her talent. Also, just FYI, nice stores have sweatshop clothes too, as all non-idiot people know. Anyway, on to Carly, who did some research on Magic Mountain. Zach is tall enough to go on the rides so Steve can take him the next day. And this is when Donna and Brandon come back to the beat office looking ashen and gently break the news to Steve about Rush owning the building that the sweatshop is in. And Steve is remarkably unconcerned, essentially saying that Rush has no responsibility for what tenants do in his buildings, which not sure the law lines up with that opinion. And Brandon tries to tell Steve that Rush would definitely know about the fire code and sanitation violations that the company has been cited for. And Steve finally gets all snitty, but says he'll check into it. And Brandon glares like a dick.
Also, so you don't let the subject of your story's kid check into your story. In fact, neither of you works on this story at all. You farm it
Thank
out.
You. I'm about to get to that because I have a lot of comments about conflict of interest, but we'll get to them. So somehow, even though Rush owns a bunch of real estate companies, he happens to be meeting with Steve under a giant sign for Sand Trap Properties, the owner of the sweatshop building. Rush is, of course, jocularly denying knowing anything about there even being a garment company in the building in question. He will check into it himself. And Steve seems like he maybe can tell that Rush is full of shit, but he leaves on a sorry I asked rather. And then Donna is making a whole aphrodisiac meal with oysters and asparagus as she calls Val and asks her to cover another appointment the next day. And Val acts all put upon about splitting the proceeds like they're partners. What the fuck? But Donna says that the fee is all hers. I have no idea how this business that they're doing even works, by the way, but neither does the show, I guess. And then when Steve returns to the beat office to repeat Rush's denials, Brandon hands him a document from the county clerk. Sandtrap owns the building and is listed among the owners of Soho Mix and Match, which means Rush is liable for labor and sanitation violations. And Steve dismisses this as some corporate thing, and there are a zillion reasons that Sandtrap might be mentioned as an owner. And Brandon has to put on his most mournfully grave face as he explains why he has to report the whole story, including Rush's involvement. And here he should probably pass this story to a less conflicted journalist and publication. But sure, let's pretend that's how this works. Like, it's not. But Steve switches into defending Rush and things get ugly in clip 13.
Donna saw one person get a little steam burn.
That one person was a kid.
Oh, please, spare me the sermon. We both know this isn't about some kid.
Really? What's it about, Steve? Circulation? Notoriety?
The LA Times turned you down for a job, didn't they? Well, a big expose like this would be your way of showing them they were wrong, wouldn't it?
You're way off base.
Maybe. But maybe you want to succeed so badly, you don't care who gets hurt along the way.
I don't like doing this.
Then don't do it.
I have to.
Then keep my father's name out of it.
I don't think I can.
Like, this is just, there's no way you would, even if Brandon did report this story, like, you would have no credibility in doing it if it was at a publication that Rush owned, like, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, whose kid is the publisher?
Yes, and who Brandon, the journalist, has known, like, for 10 years at this point, or whatever, 8.
I just, I mean, the one enjoyable thing about this is Steve being like, you just want your Pulitzer. Like, I don't think that's true. I think he just wants to, whatever, do journalisming.
Uh-huh.
But Brandon's face during this exchange is infuriating.
It really is. And the other thing is, like, if you're not trying, if you don't think that Brandon should be running down big stories, leaving aside who's implicated in this particular one, like, what is the point of this venture? like you can't install him as the editor and then be like, you just want to break big stories. Like, yeah, he does. That you should want him to, unless you're going to decide, like, no, we're exclusively, like, you know, a music rag or something. Like, I don't fucking know. Like, if you're trying to be a news organization, then this is what Brandon should be doing if your dad was not involved, which he is.
Yeah. And I don't actually see the big deal, since apparently Rush is not a producer after all, but it's just like a sort of catch-all business guy.
Rich guy.
TM.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's like, just go back to the office and be like, apparently your dad is involved in this somewhere in a holding company. We have to get a freelancer on it. Also, we need an ombudsman. Also, we need some secretaries. Also, we need a printer. Also, we need to jump in the fucking Pacific and drown. Not in that order.
We need to go get some separates from Soho Mix and Match, fill them with lead pipes, and walk into the sea. Anyway.
Take a fruit roll up. You might get hungry.
Set it on fire. And of course, what with all his dad's sweatshop running, Steve isn't there when Carly and Zach show up at the Peach Pit to meet him for the Magic Mountain trip. Whoops. In his car, Brandon and Donna discuss whether, and her no bra, by the way, discuss whether it's worth pursuing the story, even if it upsets Steve. And when the workers come out, Olivia is not among them. And Brandon has to go because of the lineup, which we've already discussed. So Donna says she will wait there. And then Olivia shows up at the Beat office looking for Brandon. And Steve is on his way out when Olivia tells the production manager, or whoever, that lady they hired, that she works for Soho Mix and Match, and Steve's ears prick up at the mention of Brandon's bid for a Pulitzer Prize. Steve's about to flounce out when Olivia says that she got fired for talking to Donna, and Steve comes back as she starts crying because he actually is the most decent of them all, and he finds her account convincing, getting out a tape recorder so that she can start from the beginning. And then Steve is at his dad's office where Rush is, of course, practicing his putting. Like, we get it. He's a shitty business guy. This is really gilding the lily. But now Steve wants answers about Olivia's story, and Rush denies responsibility for labor violations. So Steve has to tell him he knows that Rush is an owner of Soho Mix and Match. And Rush claims his business is complicated and this whole situation is just a politically incorrect snafu. Clip 14.
1 minute you're investing in a rental property, the next minute you're playing nanny to 44 immigrant workers.
How'd you know it was 44 workers?
Steve. I'm sure we can find a way to do the right thing here.
Well, that's never been my strong suit, has it, Dad? You should know that more than anyone, always telling me what a screw-up I am. Insisting that I grow up, take responsibility for my actions. Well, now it's me telling you.
Except we're talking about the real world here. Not some school prank.
That's all the more reason. And I intend to do the right thing. The question here is to you.
It's not his strong suit, which he keeps in his duffel bag.
Recalculating.
Yeah.
It's never going to end, is it?
No. So Donna returns to the beat to get caught up on Olivia's visit to the office. As they listen to the recording, they confirm it's everything they need for the story. And when Steve returns, Brandon offers to write it without Rush. Again, the reason you give the story to someone else is so that this kind of thing doesn't become an issue.
Nice ethics, dickhead.
Yep. But Steve says that Rush knew something and that Brandon should tell it straight, and that Rush promised Steve he'd fix whatever's wrong, and I'm sure he will. Cough. Brandon and Donna are proud of Steve. Donna hopes that Carly and Zach aren't too upset about missing Magic Mountain, and Steve is like, fuck, with a hilarious oopsie face, as Sarah called it. She can see the visual aids. So he has to go to Carly's house and apologize. And she's pissed, but agrees to let Steve come in and apologize to Zach directly. And Zach is even more pissed and doesn't turn around, as Steve draws a parallel between the way he let Zach down and the grown-up that let Steve down today. He hopes Zach will forgive him someday, but if he doesn't, Steve will understand. And Steve's at the door about to leave when Zach asks whether he's going to forgive the guy who let him down. Steve says he's going to try, so Zach leaps up and hugs him as Carly watches and maybe cries. It's hard to tell because Hillary Swank can't really act yet, but it's a cute moment. These two are cute.
It is cute. Kill me. I mean, maybe it's just because the rest of the episodes are so boring / infuriating, but I don't know. Steve and Zach being boys together is cute.
Yeah. Yes. The real love story here is between Steve and Zach, and Carly is like around also. Like, the two of them are not believable as a maybe couple eventually, but I love Steve and the kid.
Yeah, it's true.
All right. Who is your MVP?
I would say the kid again, but I'm actually going to go with the manager of the recording studio who's like, not that car, douche nozzle. Say it with Benjamin's dickweed.
I guess I will award this title to Steve, who had to do the tough thing with Rush and didn't try to weasel out of it like Brandon, the alleged journalist, did.
Yeah, and also didn't try to weasel out of it with Zach. He went over there and was like, I fucked up. So he tried.
Yes, he did. Least valuable player. Brandon.
Yes, actually, before I do my LVP, I would like to also note that Steve refers to Kane Was Able as Das Band, which is pretty rude and hilarious. David's like, what? Like, you are Jewish. Get the neck.
Seriously. I'm going to say Brandon for essentially screaming at Kelly for not picking his guy, even though he like has no cause to, and the detective told him so himself, and Brandon got all ahead of himself thinking he had solved all of this, and he didn't, and he just has to suck it.
It's tempting to pick Val or Cooper, who is engaging in clear stalking behavior, needs to have boundaries set for him, and Val does not set boundaries with him or Noah or herself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I'm going to go with Brandon for not understanding how journalisming works again, and for being short and a former drunk driver who polluted the lineup.
Yeah, nice. We also have a user submitted challenge.
Oh, God.
At Laura B. Hampton on Twitter wants us to list 5 ways people were squeefs in this episode.
Don't be such a squeef.
If only they could. 5. I know.
I could think of 5 ways Brandon was a squeef by the minute 10 mark. But okay, here we go.
Oh, God. David was a squeef in his career, thinking that he knows what he's doing, and then just essentially lining up more and more shitty credit to support a band that is never going to get him anywhere he wants to go.
Brandon was a squeef in his reportage of this story.
God, yes.
The detective was a squeef about the lineup, because that's not how it works. And
no,
even
not.
If she had picked that, if she's like, oh, I guess it is number one. Like, I'm sure that'll hold up in court.
Mm-mm.
Dude.
Val was a squeef in all of her relations with Noah, who, you know, he's not that great and she should calm down.
Yeah. I mean, I would say Rush was a squeef for basically running a sweatshop, but that seems like slightly more serious than it is squeefy. So I'm going to say that Cooper was a squeef for just being a squeef. And also he made many squeefish faces.
He did. He did.
I have to stop saying squeef or I'm never going to get through the next time. On segment, oh my God, squeef.
Was that five? Word. Did we do it?
I think so.
Okay, good.
Oh, God. Okay. Next time on Again With This, Brandon suffocates Kelly. Unfortunately, not literally. Donna out-Valerie's Valerie, and Devin and the Breitbart tones force David to grow a spine. Our visual aids will force you to grow a new stomach lining when you check those out on our website at previously.tv. That's for this and every other episode of Again With This. Follow Again With Us on Twitter at AWT90210. And you can follow the website on Twitter at PreviouslyTV. I'm Slumlord Business, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at TomatoNation. My co-host is Pulitzer Prize fighter Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is Compromised Lineup David T. Cole. He's on Twitter at Clark. Talk to you next time.
Hi, you know what to do after the beeparoonie.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.